Blog Talk Radio.
Minister Malcolm, you have suggested that there are all kinds of movements in Harlem growing that you and I don't know about.
Oh, yes. Frustration itself has been sufficient, all that was necessary to make Negroes realize the importance of banding together. And Negroes are banding together.
Banding together in what kind of movements?
Different kinds of movements, all kinds of movements, and they remain almost invisible. They remain almost unknown, but yet they are there. When I say invisible, I mean invisible in the sense that their existence is unknown, and no matter how much you try and track them down, you can't find them. And never try and find them through the Negro leaders. The Negro leaders are famous as apologists. If you recall, one of the most famous Negro leaders in 1959 was asked by you about the black Muslim movement. And he said he knew nothing about it. And the next moment, you flashed a picture on the screen with him shaking hands with me. So if you will recall. So this is their policy. This is their attitude or their reaction. They never know what's going on in the Negro community.
And what form will the activities of these various so-called invisible movements take in Harlem this summer?
An example. Commissioner Murphy. Almost every statement that Commissioner Murphy makes would give you the impression that he's encouraging the police, rank-and-file policemen, to take whatever method or measure is necessary to hold the Negroes in check. He feeds the type of statistics to the white public to make them think that Harlem is a complete criminal area, that everyone is prone toward violence. This gives the police the impression that they can then go and brutalize the Negroes or suppress the Negroes or even frighten the Negroes. Whenever something happens, 20 police cars converge on one area. This doesn't frighten Negroes. So it means that someone is either misinforming Commissioner Murphy and making him use tactics this year that he would not use 4 years ago or that the former policeman Kennedy would not use. And this force that is so visible in the Harlem community creates a spirit of resentment in every Negro. They think they're living in a police state and they become hostile toward the policeman. They think that the policeman is there to be against them rather than to protect them. And these thoughts, these frustrations, these apprehensions automatically are sufficient to make this make these Negroes begin to form means and ways to protect themselves in case the police themselves get too far out of line.
That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the beast. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the beast. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound.
Open up your eye while you're checking out the boombox. Check the
I walk around with a bigger one. I hear it all day, just so they can run the light and be upon their way.
Welcome to another episode, another fantastic episode, a very thought-provoking episode of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon Kamajan, and just like usual, we're joined by another fantastic guest. This promises to be a very important dialogue, a very time-related, very relevant dialogue concerning a vastly important issue in America, and that is the police state and many of our communities throughout the U.S., mostly in communities that are governmentally neglected. Most of the communities that I'm talking about also happen to be communities that the population is overwhelmingly black and brown. And that is, we're talking about police brutality. We're talking about the policing of these communities in America. And we're going to cover the history, the derivation of police in America. We're trying to, as usual with Your World News, well, we try to place things in as broad a context and as deep a context as we possibly can to give you to shine a light on issues that, quite frankly, the mainstream media oftentimes purposely does not place in its proper context, which continues to keep issues, very important issues, out of the public eye and therefore the public consciousness in America. And so I want to get right to it. Our call-in number, if we have any callers, is 347-945-5191. Once again, that's 347-945-5191. But I want to get right to it. I'm joined by somebody I met a year ago, and I had the pleasure of meeting her, pleasure of meeting her staff in Berkeley, California, and I saw like the very, very important and powerful work that she and you know, her colleagues are doing in the community, many members of the community throughout Berkeley and throughout that area in California are doing, and that's Berkeley Cop Watch. And I'm joined by none other than Andrea Pritchett, and I want to get right to it because this is, you know, this is the day that Malcolm X, the great Malcolm X, one of my heroes, was born, and, you know, he had the first word in this show, and he was talking about the policing of communities in America. He was talking about a police state. And in the same vein of Malcolm X, in terms of speaking truth to power, we intend on doing the same today. So welcome, Andrea. For those, you know, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. How you doing?
That's great. It's great. It's a wonderful day. It's a wonderful day for liberation and revolution. So for many of the listeners that I know they're listening right now are not really too familiar with who you are and the work of Berkeley Cop Watch. If you could introduce yourself, kind of give a brief bio of yourself, how you came to be involved with Berkeley Cop Watch, its derivation, and we can go from there.
Sure. Well, it's been about 20 years now since we started Cop Watch in Berkeley. And at the time we started it, I was working with homeless people, and I was trying to help folks get jobs and get set up. And I had recently returned from a couple of years in Africa, and I was sort of shocked. The culture shock I had was just the poverty, and it just was really glaring. So I wanted to work with homeless people. But what I discovered was that one of the greatest obstacles to their empowerment was the treatment they were receiving at the hands of police. So, excuse me. With a few other people, we began just to walk the streets and just we committed to ourselves that we would stop and watch the police as they interacted with the homeless people, knowing
right.
that privilege and power and dynamics are very much at play when, you know, a police officer stops somebody who's sleeping outside, who's totally impoverished.
Right.
And it was our experience that when we appeared on the scene and were just writing down the badge number and the details of the incident, the police often would check themselves. They
mm-hmm.
would often begin to address the homeless person with respectful terms, talk about sir and ma'am and this kind of thing. So it would change their behavior, and realizing that that was the case, we expanded and we began to recruit on that basis. Sadly, at that time, I didn't know the history of the Black Panthers. And only in the course of my work with CopWatch did I come to understand that, you know, this notion of monitoring the police and holding them accountable, you know, comes not just, you know, Brother Malcolm had so much to say that was so right on point, and that inspired the Panthers, but we also had the American Indian Movement. We also
right.
had the Brown Berets. So we've got a lot of models and a lot of history that we can call upon to inform our current struggle. And we try to do that. And at this point in CopWatch, we actually run a class through the University of California that does exactly that and tries to look at those movements. And we really promote that kind of inquiry. Myself, you know, you used the word, you know, staff to describe the people I work with. And in actual fact, we're all volunteers. I'm actually an eighth grade English history teacher.
Wow.
And yeah, I've never gotten paid for this work, and I don't really want to, because
yeah.
it's a labor of passion and love. And, you know, to be honest, for folks to get in a, you know, at this point we're driving around in cars and we're 20 years later, and the way that we watch the police is varied. We might do, you know, walk up and down an avenue and interact with people and watch the police that way. We have, in recent years, we do driving shifts. And so we'll be driving around at night and park the car down a side street. We'll get out with the video cameras. We use scanners now, and we'll try to document the incident in that way. But everybody's just doing it out of love and out of concern for the community.
That's right. Okay. How many people do you say that are consistent volunteers with CopWatch?
Well, these days we're able to get about two shifts out a week with Berkeley CopWatch. So, you know, there's folks who come to meetings. We probably, you know, we could have anywhere from, you know, 8 to 15 people who come to meetings. In terms of shifts, we have sort of a wider group of people to call on, people who just say, look, when you're ready to do a shift, give me a call. And so we try to keep it going, but we've got it every week. What's kind of exciting is that we've started an Oakland CopWatch, and it's really good. It's a solid, solid group of folks. So they have about maybe 10 core individuals, and this is all born out of the Oscar Grant murder by BART police here in Oakland. And so one of the response, you know, there's been many responses to that situation, but one solid thing that people have taken to is getting themselves trained, getting some video cameras, printing up some Know Your Rights cards, and now I've been doing shifts with them in recent weeks, and it's really exciting because we're making some strides, I think.
Right, and you just mentioned Oscar Grant. I found out, you know, early this year, just like the horrendous, I mean, I've known for a long time as well. So many people have known for a long time how poor our mainstream media is. And what I found is that, you know, I would, you know, talk to some friends and colleagues, and I'm like, did you hear about, you know what I'm saying, yet again, another brother gunned down by the police. And people were like, who are you talking about? And I said, you know, this brother, Oscar Grant in Oakland, California. And the vast majority of people I spoke to for the very first time, they had no idea. They hadn't heard. And this was, you know, 2 weeks, you know, into the new year, and they hadn't heard whatsoever. And so just in case people are tuning in that don't really know exactly what's going on, could you give us a background about who Oscar Grant was and what this whole situation is that you kind of prefaced?
Yeah, well, this you know, I think that we're becoming a bit desensitized, sadly, to police murders, and we're talking mostly murders of young men of color, because that is, you know, far and away the majority of people who are coming into conflict with the police and who are being murdered by them. And it is, we can talk more about that in a second. Oscar Grant specifically was a 22-year-old African-American man who responsibly, with his friends on New Year's, decided to take BART rather than drive. And they went into the city and they were coming back, and they were in at one of the Oakland stations, and the train was stopped. And apparently there had been some kind of altercation. Some, you know, it was a crowded train. Some guys were, there was some kind of fight. That's what we're told. The train was stopped at Fruitvale. The police went in and they chose some young men of color to pull off of that train. And they began to abuse them from the get-go. You know, there's an officer named Johannes Messerly. There was another one named Tony Peroni, both of whom worked for the Bay Area Rapid Transit Police Department. They took the kids off them, off the train, and there's all kinds of video. You know, this was captured by many from many angles on all kinds of cell phones. The doors of the train were open, and what these cell phone cameras reveal is that the officers took the kids. They started out just punching Oscar Grant right in the face. They forced these guys onto their knees. They forced them to sit down. Oscar Grant is saying, please don't tase me. Please don't tase me. I have a 4-year-old daughter. Please. You can see on the tape. You see him pleading. You see him on his knees. You see the police pushing him down. You see them get him on the ground. He's got his hands behind his back. One officer is in the process of handcuffing him. The other cop takes a second, steps back, pulls his gun out, bam, and shoots him in front of God and everybody and all those cameras. And it's so incredible and so unbelievable that we search for a reason. We say, well, maybe he was reaching for his taser. Right. Maybe he thought the kid had a gun. We're trying because we're people, we're good people, and we can't believe that such horrible things can happen.
Sure.
But the fact is that had any other human being pulled a gun on a person with their hands behind their back, execution style,
right,
they'd be called a terrorist? What other names could we find for them?
Exactly.
We contort our logic to try to find some justification for this officer's actions. But in the day and time we find ourselves, I think that the prudent thing to do is to take this officer and put him behind bars so he doesn't cause a threat to our society, if that's the basis of what they call our justice system. Shouldn't that happen? But no, that hasn't happened. This officer originally, you know, the officers at the time, they shot Oscar Grant, and eventually he died from his wounds. They didn't call any ambulance. Ambulance didn't show up for 45 minutes. What the officers did have time to do was to go around to all the people and take their cell phones. They tried to confiscate because they knew what had happened. You see, and that's sort of a material witness notion that you can confiscate cell phones and confiscate evidence and so forth. The question is, well, what crime did you think had happened there? Did you think that this cop had just killed somebody, had just murdered somebody, and that you needed to collect cell phones? No. That officer was not in custody. They didn't handcuff him right there. They were hiding evidence, and that's how the cover-up begins.
Right.
So the trial started yesterday. And, you know, Johannes Messerly is going to try to, his lawyer is going to try to convince the world that he intended to reach for his taser, despite the fact that right after the shooting, he said to two different officers, I thought he had a gun.
Right.
Well, what's it going to be, man? What's it going to be? You thought the taser is actually holstered on the other side of a police officer's body. It's on the left side. Officers shoot generally with their right side, so their service weapon is on their right side, and the taser is on the opposite side. So it's kind of hard for a variety of reasons. It's really, really really strains the imagination to believe that this guy could have thought he was tasing. And then you might ask, why would you tase a man who's already complying with your request?
Mm-hmm.
So what the prosecution has to do is they have to somehow prove what the intention in the officer's mind was. Did the officer intend to hurt this person, or was it an accident? And In this case, for those of your listeners who are familiar with the Rodney King case, you know, I remember that back in, I believe it was 1991.
Yeah.
You know, that Rodney King was a household word because the world was shocked that this video could appear of 17 cops beating this one guy. It's on tape. That's a slam dunk case.
Yeah,
that was a slam dunk. And they were able somehow, you know, the desire of the system to perpetuate itself is so strong that they were willing to sacrifice riots and public disapproval, et cetera, to exonerate those cops because they need to send a big message with these court cases. They need to send a message to their cops that says, it's okay, guys. You keep doing what we tell you to do. You keep holding the masses down. We got you back. Don't you worry. And it's also a message to you and me, which is that, look, at any time we want, we can take your life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's been pointed out with times. You know, it's true. It's like a judge doesn't have that power. The president doesn't have that. A Congress president. Nobody has the power that a cop does to actually just stand there and shoot you down. No process, no nothing but their own reflex, their own judgment to take your life. So, you know, I'm scared for Oakland because we also had this, you know, a couple months ago, in I guess it was in March, there was a guy named Lavelle Mixon who was stopped by Oakland police. And he looked on it and he said, wow, I'm not, he was on probation, was on parole. And his experience and his life and his disappointments and his hopelessness informed his decision, I reckon, that when these police stopped him, he decided, I'm not going back to jail. And so he shot two cops, and then he fled, and it was a two-hour manhunt. And a SWAT team knew what apartment he was in, but they decided to just storm it anyway, and he was able to take two other cops out. And so now, and then, of course, he was shot. So five families, at least, mourn. But the tensions in this community are so high. You know, because these murders are not the only ones. We've got Jody Woodfox. We've got Gaspar Banjo. We've got, I could go on and on. With again, men of color, mostly young, who have been killed basically for being men of color. And there's no justice in that. So this community out here is bubbling and boiling. And I'm really nervous. This case, I'm really kind of discouraged to hear you say that it hasn't gotten much play nationally because the Rodney King beating was international, was all over. And what that suggests to me, if Oscar Grant's case is not shocking and outrageous to the whole country, that just measures how much ground we've lost in the last couple of decades.
And it's incredible. I mean, you bring up a whole bunch of salient points. And not only has not this case gotten a lot of national attention, but even, you know, Adolph Grimes, you know, the brother that was shot and killed in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
In his parents' house. Not many people talk about that. But you bring up a really good point is that, you know, when this happens, you know, when these kind of things happen instantly, and it shows you that we're not even close to living in a post-racial era. I mean, I wouldn't want to live in a post-racial era anyways, but because, when I look in the mirror, I am very pleased, you know, with the black man that I see. But the whole term, you know, post-racial, meaning that, you know, that we've moved beyond racism in this country. It's almost amusing to hear people talk about that because when these things happen, people instantly, most of the time, give the police officers, the cops, mm-hmm. the benefit of the doubt. It must, what was this brother doing? What was he doing? All right, what was he doing to provoke them to shoot him? You know, as if,
right.
You know what I'm saying? There needs to be a reason, as if this hasn't happened before without any kind of provocation whatsoever. And so, it's just amazing that, you know, it's just, oh, this is a, you know, this is a black man, this is a Latino man. And unfortunately, even the case of older black women like Anita Gay. I mean, I believe she was shot in her back. This was in
mm-hmm.
you know, the Oakland area as well.
Berkeley,
they don't need any provocation. And they know that they can get away with it most of the time. They know that, you know, if it's filmed, in the case of Rodney King, there's a chance that they can get away with it. And God forbid it's not being filmed or it's not being recorded in some shape, form, or fashion. You almost don't stand a snowball's chance in hell of getting justice, you know.
Right.
And so,
right.
You know, these are all things that I just, what we brought up just kind of just jumped out at me. And it leads me to ask you the question, What is the history of police in America? What's the derivation of that? What was the foundation it was built on? Because a lot of times people don't, you know, they don't put things in kind of sequence order and look at the intersectionalities that have created this situation. I love on your website, you know, you had the dialogue from Dr. King, you know, mentioning riots or the language of the unheard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, where does this come from? Where does this, as the CIA calls it, blowback, where does this come from? And so what is the history of policing in America?
Well, you know, the thumbnail sketch of police in America is this, that police were created basically, I mean, if you look in the South, police were white men who were sort of deputized by the sheriff to catch slaves. That's basically the function, to catch slaves and to patrol areas of freed blacks. It was about controlling poor people. It was about controlling black people. You know, it's just that simple. You know, and eventually they got training and uniforms and blah, 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 but its origin, the need, the quote-unquote need, came from that. Now, in the Northeast, it was similar. You know, as the Industrial Revolution was happening and factories were popping up and there was, you know, this flood of immigrants from Europe, the ghettos in the cities, you know, had lots of poor people who came over here with notions of justice and decency, and they would go on strike at the factories and strike for better wages and better working conditions. So police in the Northeast were strike breakers. They were big, burly dudes that you would hire with, you know, give them a big stick and tell them to go beat the daylights out of all those people who were taking over the factory. You know, and the same, you know, again, Texas Rangers and the whole, it's the same story with the Southwest. Again, it was about, you know, harassing Mexicans who were on their own land, but you know, harassing them out of there so that white settlers could basically take over that land in the Southwest and California and New Mexico and so forth. So the origin, the whole function, the whole essence of police is about the intentional, surgical, strategic use of force to accomplish domestic political aims, and to maintain a particular social order, as we notice in America, that favors obviously a certain race and class of folks. So the history of police is like that. I also, though, as you were speaking, I was remembering a little bit of other history around this notion of freedom and all the lofty notions of America and our history. And I'm thinking about the Civil War, and I'm thinking about the post-Civil War. I'm thinking about Reconstruction and when Reconstruction ended, about 1876. And I'm thinking about Ida B. Wells. She was an African-American reporter at the turn of the century who spent her time documenting lynchings. And between 1878 and 1898, in that 20-year period, she documented about 10,000 lynchings in America. And if you break it down by year, that talks about 500 a year. Now, remember, America was, you know, at that time, like 30, 32 million people. Well, we're about 10 times the size of that now. We're about 300, we're over 300 million now. So imagine, you know, if you woke up this morning and realized that you lived in a country where, let's instead of 500, proportionally that would be 5,000. And you say, wow, 5,000 lynchings in a year, that's crazy. But people, let's get real. How many people are dying at the hands of police in this country every year? Now, I have heard a chief of police guesstimate that in California, over a four-year period, his average is about 400 people in California in custody deaths per year. Now, California, I think we have a population of maybe 28 million. So again, we're about a tenth of the country's population. So you see what I'm saying is that the violence hasn't stopped. The violence, the terrorizing violence against poor people, against people of color in this country has never stopped. It has merely changed its form. And I think the reason why people don't want to look squarely, why we do these contortions to try to go, what did you do to make that cop do that to you?
Yeah.
Because the other question we would have to ask is, why did the cop do that to you? why would a cop do that to you?
Mm-hmm.
And if we really look at that, we have some really uncomfortable questions we have to answer. America's not a free place, guys. And if we really think about it, are we ready to make it be so?
Right.
And what, that's some pretty wrenching stuff. The Civil War was not a picnic. You know, that was some deep stuff. And a lot of people felt like that had to happen in order for this notion of America as a place of freedom and equality to be realized. But the Civil War did not end. And again, you know, you can come on cop watching with us. If anybody's in doubt, come on out. And let's take a look at it. You tell me then, if I'm off the mark, come and set me straight. But really, to my eyes, that's what I see.
Right. And you said, you know, people can come out cop watching with you. I see that there's other, you know, I was going to ask you if there's, are they affiliated with you? I was, you know, checking out. I see that there's, you know, different cop watches in different cities, mainly, I guess, in the West. Are they affiliated with you?
I love the part where Malcolm X is saying that most of these movements you won't even hear about.
Yeah.
I really related to that because cop watching, you know, we have avoided. We don't want to be like the headquarters of National Cop. We're not trying to be an infrastructure. We're trying to be a consciousness. Because, number one, the left will never have, at our level of organizing, our grassroots level, we're never going to have the kind of money or resources that it would take to, you know, hire the people and get the equipment. Blah, blah, blah. People have to do this for themselves in their own communities. The consciousness is this. Watch the police. Document. Use the knowledge and the documentation to tell the truth and to communicate with people in your neighborhood about what's going on. You know, follow the facts. If your police aren't doing anything bad, great, good, God bless. But if your police really are abusing people's rights, then as a community, you got to come together. So people have done that in various ways throughout the U.S. It's not just on the West Coast. There's a Brooklyn Cop Watch. There's New Jersey. There's Massachusetts. You know, Florida. There's just Georgia. There's all kinds of Cop Watch organizations. And there's so many that we can't keep track of it. And that we don't need to. You know, we try to network. And we try to get the word out as we can. But people have just taken our handbook. They've looked at our video, our Know Your Rights cards. And those are resources that we make available freely. People can take it, adapt it, change it, do what you want. Because it's a grassroots movement consciousness. But, yeah, at this point, you know, I'm thinking there's well over 100 Cop Watch organizations in the U.S., there's even some in, you know, Australia, Wales. You know, we've gotten inquiries and interviews from folks in France and Britain and so forth. The consciousness is, I mean, it's a very simple and yet vastly complex notion. You know, just watch the police. But when you watch, it leads you to certain conclusions that, you know, your conscience may require you to act on those.
Right. What's the minimum number of people that that you would advise, like when you have your shift? I think you mentioned before.
I used to think when it depends on what you're doing. Like if you're walking an area, and sometimes it's a good idea to walk. You go up and down the street. You've got some literature. You're talking to people and you're gathering information.
Right.
So two people is fine because you don't want to gang up on somebody. But lately we've been going out in East Oakland, you know, like 1 or 2 in the morning, and we have 4 people, 2 cameras in the car. You drive around, you see the lights, you see the cops stop somebody. Drive down a side street, leave your car there. You walk up on the situation. You've got one team that goes close to the cop. You've got a video camera because you want to hear what's being said. You want to get the details. You want to talk to witnesses. You have a second team that's across the street that's got their camera on you so that if a cop mad dogs you or does something to you, tries to attack your camera, you've got something else verifying, again, the situation and what's happened. So I felt most safe in that situation with the four people in the car. But, again, that's not always what you can do, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes you don't have the people to do that. You know, 2 or 3 is fine. I'm just saying what's ideal.
And these, obviously, I mean, it may be an obvious question. I feel it's an obvious question, but just in case, just in case someone's listening that may have a little bit of naivete in terms of American, I'm so glad you eloquently put it that we're not free. We don't live in a free society. These things don't happen in a free society. We're not living in a society that's devoid of injustices, and many of which stem from one's cultural background, one's race, gender, so forth and so forth. But I'm assuming most of these communities that you disperse volunteers to Car Wash, they're overwhelmingly communities of color. Because I don't believe, I can't recall, I'm being a little facetious right now, but I don't ever recall a bunch of, turning on TV and seeing a bunch of white moms and dads and saying, damn, those black cops, they're just beating the shit out of Johnny, you know what I'm saying? Or these cops, just in general, are just coming in and just fucking up, our community and beating our boys left and right. Mm-hmm. Am I right on this, that it's, they're
predominantly... No, you're completely right. Cop watching is just, it's crazy how, you try not to stereotype, and but you can infer certain things from the demographics. And it's true that these incidents of police misconduct overwhelmingly, not exclusively, but overwhelmingly happen in areas populated mostly by people of color. That's just true. And the race, the racial dynamics are crazy. I mean, that's what Cop Watch was started to do, was to try to educate really white people about the problem, the quote-unquote problem of police brutality. Because most white people walk around feeling protected and served by police. That's who they want to call if there's a problem. That's where they want to go. That's what they expect. They're just that way. And what we try to do is, we try to put the video in their face. Like, look what we got last night, just blocks away from where you live. How do you feel? They're doing this for you, pal. This is in your name, for your comfort, for you to feel secure. They're beating, they're strip searching children on the sidewalk. It's deep stuff. It's deep stuff. And the dynamics is, like, it's a lot of white people who go out cop watching. Because a lot of people of color, they're like, look, I deal with the police when I have to deal with them, but I try to stay away from them. And I know that if I get arrested or if I come in contact with the police, there's a good chance they're going to do something to me that they're not going to do to you as a white person.
Right.
And that demographic is tricky too. Again, it's not to say that black people aren't monitoring the police and watching the police in their neighborhoods, but to actually devote your time to going out and doing that, people of color support us. And they say, thank you for doing that, et cetera, et cetera. They're not necessarily, wanting to engage at this time in that way. We have folks who are doing it, but by and large, my friends of color are saying, use that white skin privilege because the police respond differently.
Exactly.
But it's humiliating on a level, and it's embarrassing on a level. That is so consistent.
Extremely consistent. Matter of fact, here in D.C., where I reside, D.C. and outskirts of D.C., Prince George's County, we've had a rash of police brutality cases against young brothers. Matter of fact, last year there was a 14, 15-year-old boy by the name of Delonte Rollins who was shot in the back by an undercover police officer, shot in the back while he was riding his bike, riding through the city, and he was shot in the back. And that's still an ongoing thing. I mean, we protest, we marched, from the police headquarters to the Hall of Justice, but that's something that's an ongoing thing. And you're right, the consistency is amazing, it's infuriating. On so many levels, and it's sometimes hard for me to even I can't contain myself because I just like you, I get sick of the damn excuses. When it immediately happens, the benefit of the doubt always swings to the police officer. It just angered me so much when I first heard about it, and I was telling a couple people, and they're like, well, I saw on MSNBC, they said that, like you said, he was reaching for his taser. I'm like, the brother was face down on the ground, he was handcuffed, and he was shot in the back, execution style, execution style.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, there is no excuse for this. Like, why are we giving these folks, the benefit of the doubt? This is their MO, and they've built a reputation, a strong reputation, a very proud reputation on this, to go into these communities, fuck people up, scare the shit out of them, you know what I'm saying? And, communities that have been devoid of so many different economic resources that opulent and predominantly white communities are privy to. And so you have these, it's just infuriating on many levels. And I was looking at your website and I saw the memoriam of people that have been killed. I see Mac Woodfox,
right.
Leslie Allen, Casper Banjo, Anita Gay. What's been going on in the Oakland, California area, in Berkeley? It seems like there's been a rash, and I see Anita Gay was shot and killed in Berkeley.
Yeah. She was a grandmother who was...
A grandmother?
Yeah, she was 51 years old. And there was some... there was some domestic trouble in that situation in that household. And in fact, the officer who shot her was an African American man.
Mm-hmm.
And so some people are going to run with that ball and go, "Oh, well, see, no, it was about racism, blah blah blah." But you know what? Let's remember. I think what some folks have to remember is that, you do not have to be white to carry out a racist agenda.
Okay, thank you.
And I think we really, if we're really going to ever combat racism, then we have to understand the theory and the theories behind it.
Right.
And, how is it that there was 3 million whites in South Africa who were able to enslave and control 27 million people of color during, South African apartheid? It's because you have a system and you have weapons to back up that system.
Right.
And, California is a state that's looking at, soon it's going to be majority people of color. Now the question, will the resources and will the distribution of wealth and will the distribution of power, be proportional to that demographic? No, it's not. It's not. This situation in California, if ever there was a wake-up call, I think the Oscar Grant's a wake-up call. Unfortunately, his family is an amazing group of folks. His mom is a minister with a PhD. His family is very tight and together. They're very, on the literature they recently put out, the pictures of several of these people, these young men who have been killed. They also included a picture of Emmett Till.
Yeah.
50 years ago, killed, 14-year-old kid, killed by Klan violence because he had the audacity to look a white woman in the eye. And that, they see themselves in the context of history. They see themselves. And I think we need to. I think that's what's lacking. That's why our movements never get any traction and never build on themselves, because we don't see ourselves in that flow, in that tide of history. And so we don't build on the victories and we don't build on the experience and the knowledge. I was just watching a movie the other night called Every Mother's Son, which is a documentary which was about Amadou Diallo's mother and her struggle for justice. Anthony Baez's mother and her struggle for justice, and another woman whose son, she was a Jewish woman, her son was also killed. In none of those cases was there justice. And let's remember the Sean Bell in New York City, the bridegroom. Those cops walked. Where were the riots? Where was this? Blah, blah, blah. Help us, people, because if we accept this, we might as well accept gas chambers and ovens. Because if we're not willing to protest, if we're not willing to be outraged, if we're not willing to sacrifice some part of our comfort and our lives and our daily routine to resist this stuff, then you better learn to love it, because more of it's coming.
Exactly. And I'm glad you brought up the Sean Bell thing. I definitely echo those words that you had. And it seems like I continually, at least maybe once or twice a week, have this kind of dialogue with students I work with or individuals I know peers of mine, is that we have to fight like hell. We can't, you know what I'm saying, we can't accept this shit. And we have to be willing to make some kind of sacrifice on some level to place ourselves outside of our comfort zone in order to create, you know what I'm saying, a better, you know what I'm saying, truly equal, you know, environment that is devoid of police brutality, that is devoid of injustice on any level, on any basis whatsoever. And it's because I see so many people that are comfortable, kind of comfortable, you know, where they are, and it's almost like you have to kind of like slap them in the face with some information to say, listen, this is the reality. And Sean Bell, you know, I tell them, I said, Sean Bell could be you. Sean Bell is me. Oscar Grant is me. Because if I was that brother, you know what I'm saying, on that BART at that same time, that would have been me. And so I do take it extremely personal, and you have to take it personal because it could be you, it could be your friend, it could be your son, it could be your father on any given day in the United States of America. It's not a game. And I think it was very telling because you mentioned that it doesn't matter, you know, philosophers from like Franz Fanon to other folks that have said this over and over again, is that, you know, sometimes you have people, you have the oppressed, you know, after a while taking upon the image of the oppressor. And so, you know, you know, just because you have a black cop within a police, the institution itself is inherently racist. And so that individual, you know, it's going to be very difficult for that individual to overcome that institution. The institution has to be broken up. And so that's where you have black or Latino cops sometimes carrying out the same type of violence and terror that you see, you know, white cops doing. And so, it's, you know, they're, you know, an appendage of a racist institution. And I thought that, you know, and I'll turn it to you, I thought it was very, very telling, and not necessarily in a good way, is that at the time, candidate Barack Obama, you know, I didn't vote for, I voted for Cynthia McKinney. But at the time, candidate Barack Obama, when the Sean Bell incident happened, the murder, the assassination, you know, occurred of Sean Bell in New York City, mm-hmm. you know, he was asked by reporters. And instead of even taking a safe answer, just not even, you know, implicating himself, he answered and said, you know, we're a nation of just laws. We need to respect the ruling of the judge. And I was like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. Yeah. You've got to be fucking kidding me. And then he never said anything about Oscar Grant, like, issuing, like, condolences. But I did notice that he issued condolences to the police officers who were killed by the brother, Lavelle Dixon or Mixon?
Mixon, yeah.
Mixon. You know, he did say that, but he didn't say a damn thing about the assassination of Oscar Grant. And that's very telling when you have a black face on, you know, on the face of the same old structure of power that has been carrying out, you know, this type of stuff, not just here in the U.S., but internationally and through imperialism, through neocolonialism, left and right. And then saying, oh, we're not going to send a delegation to the Durban 2 conference in Geneva.
Yeah.
You know, so what are your thoughts on those things?
Well, you know, I just think sometimes I just have to, you know, forget the faces and the colors and everything. Let's just fall back on the theory, you know, because some people say, but look, Andrea, what kind of conspiracy? You're alluding to some vast conspiracy that the average cop in their car, when they pull out their gun, et cetera, they're not all hooked into, and you know what? Culturally, they are, and institutionally, they are. Because, again, let's remember, what is the police in modern America? What is the role and the function? It's to maintain what is now a very crumbling order. You know, we're talking about law and order. They're upholding the law and maintaining the social order. Let's look at unemployment. Let's look at education. Let's look at these drastic, like, crisis cuts. The whole welfare state as we know it is in a transformation, is in a time of flux and change. People don't have jobs. You know, our dropout rate here in Oakland is like, you know, half of our young people of color don't even get their diplomas because of the state of education being what it is and the state of the neighborhoods being what they are. So, yeah, so the only answer, you know, is like, you know, when your children are hungry, do you give them bread or a stone? Well, these cats are throwing stones over here. And they're trying to keep, they have to maintain a restive population. They have to suppress, oppress, repress. I mean, It's all about keeping folks down and sending a message. Don't get out of line. Don't even confront me. Don't look me in the eye, because I need you to scatter when I come, because I don't have bread for you. All they gave me was this gun. You know, and that's what this society has become. And if you want to talk about police state, I think it's an apt description, because at this point, the police don't serve us. We, the machinery, we serve the machine. And the machinery of violence, the machinery of coercion, the machinery of hierarchy and suppression, that's what we have right now. And, you know, but I don't want to leave people in just a totally negative note, because there's been a lot of great thinkers and a lot of great theory poured into these notions of alternatives. You know, for example, Angela Davis and the Critical Resistance organization have really fostered some great thinking and some great research and analysis along the lines of, well, if not the police, then what? And we have to take it, let's go back 100 years. If not slavery, then what? And to be honest, that's how a lot of folks thought of it. Well, if we're not going to have slavery, what are we going to do? But some people were able to think beyond that. We're able to imagine a society that wasn't based on those kind of dynamics, those kind of social relations. And I'd like to challenge folks to think about it, who think, well, if not the police, then who? If not the police, then us. Mm-hmm. You know, think about your neighborhood, man. If everybody in your neighborhood was well-fed, well-read, was, you know, well-clothed and cared for, what would the crime rate be? What do you think it would be? You know, I think a lot of this so-called crime is just a response to poverty and a response to economic conditions. So, you know, when I think about the Panthers, and I think, well, what was the most threatening thing about the Panthers? Was it the fact that they advocated self-defense? Or was it the fact that they advocated self-sufficiency? You know, was it the fact that they, like, you know what, forget you guys. Let's feed our own children. Let's give bags of groceries to the old people. Let's set up our own schools. Let's do all this kind of stuff. You know, they, when you say you want no part of the system, that's when they get really nervous. When we start constructing those alternatives, that's the revolution. That is the revolution. When we go to the court date and we go to the complaint board and we go to all their little processes and institutions and watch them do their dance and shuffle their cards and, you know, try to give this illusion like, oh, hey, maybe you win, maybe you lose. That's the justice system. You know, pick a lotto number and maybe we'll call yours and maybe you get justice. Forget it. That's not a justice system.
Yeah.
You know, so I think the challenge for us is to, yes, on the one hand, we have to oppose police brutality and we have to expose it and organize around it, but we also need to be thinking 20, 30, 50 years from now. What does the society look like?
What is it?
You know, is it authoritarian or is it more democratic? Is it more egalitarian? How can we break the vice grip hold, the stranglehold that the police have on us? You know, they've created this dependence. Call 911. Call us. Call us. Call us. And we've grown the police so big that now Oakland can't even hire more police because they can't afford it.
Yeah.
You know, have you heard about the privatization of the police?
Yeah.
Where they're trying to, you know, it costs about $250,000 to keep one cop on the beat for a year. We take their salary. They start at $80,000. You take their salary, you take their benefits, you take the equipment it takes, it's $250,000. So Oakland realized, well, we need more cops, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to hire these other guys for $50,000 each.
And
what a great savings.
Good. Yeah.
That's not good at all, because these guys are going to be kicking in doors and shooting people, and we're not going to have any accountability of these guys.
Those folks are going to be Blackwater, they're going to be DynCorp.
That's...
Matter of fact, Blackwater was policing the streets of New Orleans.
Exactly.
And they were, you know what I'm saying, and there was you know, evidence that they shot, you know, a bunch of civilians during the aftermath of
right.
Hurricane Katrina and the flood.
Right.
So, yeah, it's horrible. Andrew, what if, because, you know, we have about 5 minutes left, and what we try to do with this program is to try to bring people together from various communities and movements, and you guys are doing some positive, some really, really powerful stuff. And I know some of the listeners who are tuning in right now, I know them very well, and they, you know, when they learned about the show today, you know, their ears came up, their eyes opened wide, and they wanted to know more about it. How can people get in contact with you they just want to ask you questions about CopWatch, and also some of them, you know, may have the idea that they want to try to start something similar in their community, whether it's here in D.C. or Baltimore or what have you. How can they get in contact with you to pick your mind, to pick other volunteers' minds?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You can call. You can actually contact Berkeley CopWatch and Oakland CopWatch are sharing a same telephone number, different mailboxes. So you can call 510-548-0425 and leave a message for us, and we'll get back to you. Yeah, we do a lot of, you know, chatting with folks from all over the country. And, yeah, we also have an email. We're at berkeleycopwatch@yahoo.com. And they can check out our website, berkeleycopwatch.org. Yeah, we'd love to network with folks, definitely. And, again, people are free to download any of the resources on our website. Please take them, modify them, make them yours.
Because you have Know Your Rights pamphlets and stuff like that as
we Yeah. And we also have a handbook that if you're somebody who's interested in maybe starting a CopWatch in your area, this is the original handbook of how to get started, what materials you use, what you might want to keep in mind as you're doing it, what information you want to document. And also we have a video called These Streets Are Watching, which you can actually watch. There's links to it on our website. You can watch it online. It's about a 50-some minute video, or you could contact us if you want a copy. We'll send you a copy. But it's actually really helpful. It's got a lot of really practical advice in it, and it's all made up out of footage that we've taken over the years from actual CopWatch shifts. So it was edited really well, and it looks good. So if anybody's interested in that, they should give us a buzz, give us a ring.
Definitely. Well, I'm going to be giving you a buzz because I'm interested in it, especially with the group that I work with here in Washington, D.C. Area called Black Male Initiative, where we just started to do Know Your Rights trainings in community centers and middle school,
mm-hmm.
and high school. So I'm definitely going to holler at you for that. Mm-hmm. But I want to just thank you so much, and I'm going to leave the door wide open. The invitation is always open for you to come on. If something's going on, you know, I definitely want to have you on again to get an update on the trial that's going on.
Hopefully we see
some justice, but the door is always open in order for you to come on and to build with myself as well as the community that we have here in Washington, D.C. Because, you know, as you say, you know, these, you know, with the digits that you have on your attached to your wrist, you know, they're much more powerful when you close it and make a fist. And so we definitely have to continue to build and work together. So I just want to thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
All right. Take care.
Yeah, you
and,
too.
And everyone out there, thank you for tuning in, and I look forward to seeing you guys next week. And definitely pay homage to Malcolm X. This is his birthday, and we'll close with Weapon X.
Yeah, yeah, ultra banger, Philly with it, Weapon X, yeah. I'm not known for the singing of the common man's grammar. Jay from the clan, but I'm not a Wu-Tanger. Concrete gorilla, still spitting bananas. We set the foundation by swinging a new hammer. Glitz and the glamour come secondary to my timeless jewels and street knowledge degree.
Come on.
Weapon X, haters down on your knees. Throw your rhymes in the flames and repent to the east. 1, 2, 3, and a 3, 2, 1. X to dust, hip-hop redemption. Resurrection, tell folks I'm on one. Like my boy and Amistad, me want free, dumb. Round the mountain I come, Hannibal's descendant won't stand for minimum. Dummy builds gunners, I bring the hella heat. My underground scroll spellbound in the streets.
Weapon X, contact for the next level boom.
He's back,
Philly mortal, dark sun, give me room.
Weapon X,
Grand Bird, modern day Doc Doom.
I'm on it for the jihad, the cypher.
Boom.
Brooklyn's where I'm from. My sole agenda is to rep the Afrikaan in a hip-hop manner. We come a long way from a bird-stick lick to a dark sun ray. In the state of war, verbalizing the peace. My hostility is toward clerics of the beast. That's why I don't cease when I resurrect fam. Community soldiers who onslaught the jam. Positive thinking, my streets be sticking with the wrong kind of pimping. To turn on our own is the first step to simping. Chain of fools, kids set tripping on the steps of school. Tell folks to cool and possess finesse. Or be a contribution to the prison business. You know how it goes, son, there's nothing to guess. You can be a strange fruit and be straight innocent.
Weapon X, contact for the next level boom.
He's back,
Philly mortal, dark son, give me room.
Weapon X.
that walk that black crowd.
Think.
As if you were born in the street.